I think we're sounding decent.
Okay.
So let's go.
Here we go. Hello again, I'm Simon Mercip, and this is Crave, the podcast dedicated to film, music, theatre, television, anything that's been entertaining Steve McCabe and I lately.
And this week, we're going from the serious to the absolutely bizarrely, profoundly absurd and silly. We're going to start with a look at the Oscar-tipped drama Spotlight, and then we'll go to the other end of the spectrum with Ben Stiller's comedy Zoolander 2.
And along the way, I'll offer a thought or two on television's revamped, rebooted X-Files. Although, actually, you ask how revamped it is in some ways. It's the same actors, it's the same theme music, the same opening titles. Something to think about. And how on earth did a New Zealand comedian land a starring role in one of these episodes? There's a thought.
The answer is out there somewhere.
I want to believe.
No, of course you do, of course you do. So, we're going to start with Spotlight, aren't we?
Yes, so... But basically, and this is another... Just like last week, Steve, when we were talking about The Lady in the Van, which was mostly a true story.
Yes.
This is a true story. It tells about a special investigations unit at the Boston Globe newspaper, the unit's called Spotlight, which uncovers child abuse by many of the city's Catholic priests and also uncovers how the church hierarchy knew about it and covered it up, which is all rather heavy going, to say the least.
It is. I mean, for someone who grew up Catholic and went to Catholic schools in his childhood, it's uncomfortable to watch. Not that I'm in any way leading anywhere with that revelation, but yeah, this was never going to be a light and easy watch, was it?
No. One thing that it struck me quite early on about this, because I'm of a generation to have been hugely influenced in my teenage years by another great journalism film of the 70s, All the President's Men, which, of course, was about the Watergate scandal and had Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman playing the two, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein. That film really took you inside the journalistic process, how the journalist uncovered the story. And that film didn't deal a lot in the actual incident itself. It was a little bit of a hint of it or a snapshot of it at the very beginning. And I thought this was a little similar to that, Steve. At the very, very beginning, you get a little bit of the aftermath of one incident inside a police station.
Yes.
And from that point on, yes, we do hear from a couple of victims, but the film's not really about the victims, is it? And we don't even get to really see or get to know any of the actual priests either, their names that we hear bandied about during the course of the film. But this is a story about how the journalists, got the story.
It is. It's very much about the story. In fact, the filmmaking itself is extraordinarily low key. It's not flashy. It's not showy. It's not dramatic in any way. It's very understated. The lighting is very, very flat. The colours are slightly muted and subdued. It's not about the film. There's no spectacle. It's purely about the story that they're trying to dig up. Even the acting is understated. There's no dramatic speeches and declaiming of actors. There's none of that kind of nonsense. About the story. There's a couple of key sequences where it's even about the journalistic process. You see cases, for example, wonderfully acted turn from Leif Schreiber as Marty Baron, the outsider, the, as they describe him, the baseball hating gentleman of the Jewish persuasion from Miami, who's drafted into Boston to head the newspaper up, who tells them, this is not a story yet. Here's the story I want from you. When that story's been written, then bring it to me and we'll run it. And you see an awful lot of the way that he runs his newspaper, how he gets his people to develop a story for him.
Yep. I think that's absolutely right. It's kind of a clarion call to journalists and the role of the Fourth Estate in a community and why it needs to remain independent and not be swayed by interest groups that might try and pull it in one direction or another. And I think it tells that story really, really well. I agree with you. It's almost a dry interpretation of what could be a very sensational subject matter. But I think overall that's a good thing.
Yes.
It doesn't.
It could have been hideously lurid, couldn't it?
Yes.
It could have been quite squalid and nasty. I think we briefly meet one of the priests in passing, don't we?
Very briefly, true, yes. But, yeah, it's not, we don't dwell on it.
No, it's not about the crimes. so much as it's about the investigation of the crimes.
Yep. And I have to say, having spent a year or two or 20 in a newsroom here and there around the place, I thought the way they represented a cross-section of journalists, I thought was pretty good. You had the sort of the one guy digging and ferreting and going through all the records, the woman who was quite a compassionate interviewer to get information out of the subjects, the more of the tearaway journalist with a bit more fire in his belly, that was Mark Ruffalo, and the more experienced old hand who's made a few mistakes in his time, as we hear, but is trying to correct what he might have done in the past.
That would be Michael Keaton you're talking
Michael
about.
Michael Keaton, I thought he was very good. In some ways, I thought he was my main guy, really, even though Mark Ruffalo, for most of the, got the top billing, I kind of felt it was more Keaton's story. Look, and at the very end, as they often do with these sort of films, Steve, don't they? They kind of wrap it up with some text that you can, that bring you up to speed with what happened with the case. And there was a list of countries and places and countries where various crimes had been committed. And I have to say, rather soberingly, if you looked, glancing at the list, New Zealand popped up more than a few times.
I did see references to Hamilton and Christchurch. I'm sure there were more.
Yeah, I think
they're the ones I happened to catch notice of. Yeah. So, yeah, it's a horrible subject. It's a horrific topic that we know. It keeps on coming in the newspapers all the time. It's very real, and it's very recent. I believe the story dates back to the mid-90s, doesn't it? Possibly the late 90s was the actual investigation itself that Spotlight ran.
Yeah.
So this is very recent and very raw for a lot of people. And I think it was handled with elegance.
I think that's a good word. So I think it's a film. Would you buy a ticket? Well, yep, yes, I would, but I would go along to see that, expecting to have to take a bit of a deep breath, knowing I'm going to see something fairly weighty, fairly serious, but treated with some intelligence and, as you say, some elegance.
And I have to say that I think you get your money's worth for one performance that's definitely worth mentioning. The only showy, flashy performance at all, because I don't think he's capable of anything else, is Stanley Tucci.
Oh, yes.
As Mitchell Garabedian.
He's great. I think he's fantastic, that guy. He plays this lawyer who's been actually on this case for ages and has almost given up on the media, hasn't he? But finally, one of the Spotlight team convinces him to play ball with them and they get the result. But yes, I agree. He's Stanley Tucci is... he's just a great guy, an actor to watch doing his craft.
And even he, to be fair, reins it in somewhat.
I think he does.
He's capable of dialing it up to 11 at least. But you can still say this is a man who knows exactly what he's about. It was an exceptional performance within the context of a very difficult subject. I was impressed.
Yeah, likewise. Okay, good. A couple of ticks there in the column for
me. Oh, definitely. Absolutely.
Now, next, something rather different.
Well, let's go sideways first. There's one that we forgot to mention in the setup. We forgot to mention Steve Jobs.
Oh, yes, we did. How could we?
Well, you're not an Apple user very much, are you?
No. But right. I know about him. But no, I'm not. But you are. So maybe you should lead off on this and you've seen the film.
Well, given that I'm recording this episode on my Apple laptop with my Apple iPhone sitting next to me and my Apple Watch strapped to my wrist, yes, I am. I'm a bit of an Apple fan. But the man is an interesting character, Steve Jobs. Famously a loathsome individual. Famously a very prickly, very difficult to work with man. And as a result, he was always going to make an interesting topic for a film. And he's clearly produced products, so he's responsible for products that have had a huge impact on the world we live in. So how on earth do you attack a topic like this? How do you get into it? And the structure that they chose for this, the structure that's been put together. Let's see, the director's Danny Boyle, who... We know originally from things like Trainspotting many years ago.
Right, yeah.
And he used a screenplay by Aaron Sorkin, who is also responsible for things like West Wing.
Okay.
So it's always going to be very theatrical, very talky, very lots of big, meaningful speeches.
Yep.
But it's got a fairly sound grounding in Walter Isaacson's biography of Jobs that he wrote with Jobs' close cooperation in the man's dying years.
Okay.
So what we get is fairly accurate. We've got Michael Fassbender playing Steve Jobs in three specific episodes in the man's life, and all three of them are product launches.
Okay, that's rather appropriate.
The first one is the original Macintosh computer back in 1984.
Yeah.
Then there's the next computer, which was the product that he was responsible for after he was ousted from Apple. And then there was the iMac, which was the first of the big products that turned Apple's fortunes around after he was brought back in. And so the way that the film is set up is it's backstage before he goes on stage to announce these three products.
Okay.
We never actually see him on stage. What we see him in is green rooms and dressing rooms before he goes out on stage to talk up his products.
Okay.
So it's a very claustrophobic film.
Yeah. And that is quite theatrical as well, as you say.
It's very theatrical, and yet it's in very confined spaces. And you've got Fassbender doing a very, very controlled performance of a very tightly controlled man.
Yeah.
And Kate Winslet, opposite him, is Joanna Hoffman, basically the only woman in the world who could actually get through to him. His one confidant.
Yeah.
Now, the real Joanna Hoffman was, I believe, of Polish extraction, possibly even of Polish birth. And Winslet plays her with the faintest hint of a Polish accent. The opportunities for scenery chewing were enormous, and she doesn't take them, to her eternal credit.
Right.
So it's quite brilliantly done.
And I just have to ask you, because as you said right at the very beginning there, Steve, the reputation of the man is, you know, a little, you know, rather prickly, not the bloke you might want to share a beer with necessarily.
No.
Does this film break that down a little bit, or give a bit more insight into what's really making him tick and why he might be that way?
Not so much, really, no, to be honest. There are references, as the film goes on, to the fact that he was adopted and that he interpreted that not so much as the fact that he was chosen by his adoptive parents, but the fact that he dwelt on his abandonment by his birth parents.
Yeah.
And so he chooses to view it in that way. And not being adopted myself, I can't speak to how reasonable that is. But that was clearly his interpretation. He believed that he had been rejected. And clearly the chip on his shoulder was a weight that he carried all through his life.
Yeah. Well, that's a chip that many people carry. So that can be a very strong spur.
Yes.
Right through their lives, something like that.
But the irony is that one of the other main characters that keeps appearing all through the film is a girl, then a young woman, named Lisa Brennan, whose mother, Chris Ann Brennan, insisted that Jobs was the father of her daughter, Lisa. And eventually he did acknowledge paternity. But for years, in the film, for about 14 years, he denied paternity. Very publicly and very offensively. At one point, he famously suggests that one man in four could have been the father.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah, not a classy man.
No.
Not a classy man. And so a recurring theme is the conflict between Jobs and the mother, between him and Chris Ann Brennan, played by Catherine Waterston. And it just shows that he is very driven. And he won't be told anything by anybody. And he's not presented at all as a sympathetic character. And quite frankly, I don't know how you could anyway.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And good on them for not even trying to do that.
No.
And good on them for not trying to hide this paternity saga that was bubbling away all those years too.
Well, it's too well known. When you have a character as prominent as Steve Jobs, who has been very well documented over the years, you can't. You can't just pretend, oh, it didn't happen, really, or we'll just hand wave it away. The original Apple computer that had the point and click interface was the Apple Lisa, and it was named after Lisa Brennan.
Right.
Even though he tried denying it to his daughter's face, and obviously, you know, even at the age of five, she was saying, you're full of it, mate. But he's clearly not a very pleasant character. And so they develop his relationship with his partner in the founding of Apple, Steve Wozniak, who's played quite brilliantly by Seth Rogen.
Okay. Oh, really?
Yes.
Ah. With a straight face.
He plays it... Well, I mean...
Straightish.
Wozniak was always... Of the two, he was always the more personable, the more cuddly, the more approachable individual. And so Rogan, while he's not being his goofy frat boy kind of idiot character, the character he usually plays, he still brings warmth to the character that obviously Steve Jobs is completely lacking.
Yeah. So interesting.
Quite lovely. And Jeff Daniels as John Scully, who was responsible for Jobs' ouster from Apple in the first place, is superb. He's okay. not the comedian, not the comic actor that you're expecting him to be half the time. He's definitely growing. I mean, how old is the guy these days, Jeff Daniels? I mean, he must be in his 50s. But he's finally maturing.
He was good in The Martian, I remember, too.
Yes, very, very good.
I'm hearing a big tick also on this one from you, Steve, in your voice, pretty obviously. But if you were someone who either had never really followed the Apple story very much and wasn't very familiar yourself with the backstory, and so you just went along to this film with a fairly open mind, how would it grab you? That would be my question.
Now, that's a really interesting question. Mm. Obviously, I approach this with background knowledge. I own some of the products that he's announcing, and I've got context to this. But even if you're not that familiar with the man's life story already, it's a very, very well-developed, very, very tightly drawn study of a character. Like I say, Aaron Sorkin wrote it. The man is a gifted and talented screenwriter. You've got outstanding performances from the four principals.
Yeah.
It's a very, very tightly produced piece of cinematic theatre.
It's tough.
Or possibly should we go with theatrical cinema? I'm not quite sure. It's on the cusp between the two. Fantastically talky. It demands your attention, but I think it's a very, very well put together piece of film.
Yeah. And I must say, Fassbender is a pretty compelling actor as well. I'd go see it just to see how he tackles the role.
Hard to beat.
So if you've just joined us, this is a rather movie-heavy, laden episode of Crave. This is our entertainment podcast that Steve McCabe and I, Simon Mercier, launch into the stratosphere or some sphere every now and then. And you can reach us on Twitter and Facebook, and we'll tell you all about that a bit later on. Now, there's one more movie, Steve, we need to pass mention of. As you say, a really, really different film, my word.
Well, Spotlight's up for Best Picture Oscar.
Yeah.
Next one, something tells me, was never seriously a contender. just a suspicion I have there. I could be wrong.
Yeah. I think that you're on the money there. We're talking about Ben Stiller, and it's just his second comic turn as the fashion model with a look that can literally make objects freeze in midair. Derek Zoolander. Steve, not sure necessarily if discussing a plot will really help us, but
was there a plot?
Was there? I think there was.
If you say so, mate. I mean, I you'll forgive me if I couldn't. Now, I mean, there is something resembling a plot, obviously. It's complete and utter nonsense, and it's something to do with pop singers and rock stars being assassinated.
Yes, that's right. They are. And all of a sudden, Derek Zoolander, he's been this recluse. He's gone into living a solitary life because he believed he killed his wife years before. He's abandoned his son. He maimed the face of his main fashion model rival, Hansel, again played here by Owen Wilson. So how does Derek fight his way back into the modern fashion world, reunite with his son, all with the help of Hansel and a rather... Can I use the word beautiful? I can. Yes, I can.
Oh, she's gorgeous, let's face it.
Yes, beautiful fashion police boss, Valentina, who is played by Penelope Cruz.
Oh,
and
yes.
Mugatu's back. That's Will Ferrell's character. So it's take two on the Zoolander story. I guess the big thing is here, Steve McCabe, did we laugh?
From start to finish.
Tell me a bit more about where you were laughing. I'll tell you where I was laughing.
Well, first of all, I just have to say, it's utter bollocks, isn't it, really?
It's stupid.
There's no two ways about it. It's the biggest pile of nonsense you'll see all year. But from the very start, where, I mean, you have to cheer at any film that starts with Justin Bieber being assassinated. That right there had me. Even, and I don't think we're giving anything away here, because I believe this is even in the trailers, as he's lying dying. I mean, how many bullets did they put in him?
Oh, but a million and three, I think.
At least, yeah. They shot him well to death. And as he's dying, he pulls out his phone to take a selfie on it for Instagram. And before he dies, he flicks through the appropriate filters to make his dying selfie look good.
Yes, therein lies the tale. Yes.
Are we going to mention any of the cameos? I mean, there's one in particular that needs mentioning, isn't there?
Well, there might be a few. I think I know which one you're going to say. Can I guess? I'll guess. You want to mention Sting?
Oh, I don't, well, he's bizarre all the way through it. Yes, he's hysterically funny. There was one that was almost troubling, almost disturbing.
Kiefer Sutherland.
Okay. Kiefer Sutherland and the orgy. Yes, there is a compilation character called Orgy, and I don't think we can say any more about it than that.
I know the one you mean, Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yes, Benedict Cumberbatch playing All.
Now, I have to say, I wrote down on my list of things that I would remember from this film. There's a little scene where All, played by Benedict Cumberbatch, gives Derek Zoolander a look.
Yes.
A stare, a glare, a little bit of a tease. Ooh, it's quite spooky and scary and, ooh. I don't know what you thought about that.
Yes, it was creepy. I mean, this is one of my favourite actors. The man is brilliant. And he's obviously having a fantastic time doing it. But yeah, you just feel a little bit dirty almost.
Yeah, I know. One or two other things I thought were I'd remember. I thought Hansel and the rotor blades was quite a good little moment.
Yes.
The cat commercial made me squirm.
Moo.
Ooh. And was there, I think there was, in the aforementioned orgy, the composite character, I think there was a tattooed Maori warrior in there.
I do believe there was. In fact, I tell you what, by the power of the internet, I'm actually having a very quick look at the IMDb entry for it, and I do remember seeing, yes, here we are. He is indeed a Maori gentleman. His name is Antonio Te Maioha.
Okay.
And if that's not a Maori name, I don't know what is.
Exactly.
So, yeah, they're certainly going for authenticity here, yes.
So this is, yeah, it's a bunch of nonsense. It's kind of, at times, it made me think a little bit like an Austin Powers sort of a film, maybe.
Yes.
With a lot of people, and we've mentioned one or two, but there's heaps of other people playing themselves. So, I mean, it's just something about Ben Stiller's influence. He can pull a few strings, can't he, and get all sorts of, not just actors, but news broadcasters, fashion icons, all to play little roles in this thing.
Yeah, he's got Lenny Kravitz, he's got Kate Moss, Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's got Kanye West at one point, although I wouldn't brag about that one, to be honest. He's got an enormous number of people that you'll recognise. You wished you didn't recognise. Susan Boyle. I mean, in the end, as it just starts to implode under its own bizarreness, you think, that's him and that's her. And so, oh, dear Lord, everybody's in it.
Yes. My train spotting moment of the film involved Mr. Springsteen. Did you see that?
I turned to my wife and said, Simon's not going to like that.
No, not good. Anyway.
Yes, he pops up very early on in the list of assassinated celebrities.
Yes.
The less we say about that, the better, perhaps.
Yes, I think so. I mean, for all the cringing I did, I have to say I did laugh. And I think the irony of this film is, in some ways, this isnn't the irony. This is what it's all about. The most stupid person is the main character.
Derek Zoolander himself.
Closely followed by the second main character, Hansel.
Well, to be fair, I thought Hansel was given way more to do, and the story largely was his, really, this time.
Well, the orgy was certainly something you'd,
Well,
remember?
Orgy? It's not often you get to ask that about a film.
No.
There were two.
So, depending on your mood, I think this is worth if you're looking for a bit of a diversion on a Friday night or whatever, this is worth the price of a ticket, I'd say.
I would suggest if you see Spotlight and you found it to be a bit of a downer, and that's not unrealistic, I think you could do a lot worse than this for a pick-me-up.
Yeah, and one of the quite clever little games you find yourself playing, watching this, and I'm sure it's intentional, is you find yourself saying, ooh, okay, where's the next guest appearance going to be? Who's the next person I'm going to be surprised to see? And I think they drip feed that right through the film quite cleverly.
Yes, and it increases as it goes on. Don't expect a plot. Don't expect anything sane or rational. Expect something extraordinarily funny, because like we've said, they just keep flinging it and flinging it. And when you throw that much at the camera, something has to stick, surely.
Exactly. So, yep. Oh, gosh. Yeah. I think we're agreeing too much here, Steve. This isn't any good. Can I mention something on the small screen now?
Go ahead.
I did mention this last time that I said I would have a look at it, and I just want to follow up that I did end up having a look at, in fact, it was three episodes of the new X-Files. This is on TV2.
Now, you were something of a fan the first time around, weren't you?
I was for a while. It kind of faded as time went on, but I got into it. It was a bit of fun, and I thought the way the two main characters, Mulder and Scully, in those early days traded off each other gave it a bit of a zing and kept you going. Now they did a couple of movies, and now they've come back for what I understand is a fairly short series, about maybe only 6 or 8 episodes. And look, if you saw the original, you would recall that every now and then they would do a really funny parody of what they were all about. And so far, all of the episodes I've seen, you could say they're just, they're taking the piss is what I would have to say.
Excellent.
Yes, I mean, it looks like it's parodying itself when it was already parodying itself way back in the day.
Right, but is it a slightly more knowing parody this time?
Oh, yeah, and not just with the same key actors as David Duchovny playing Mulder and Gillian Anderson playing Scully. There are a couple of other characters who they brought back. The music's the same. The opening titles are exactly the same. They haven't even updated the photographs of the actors in the lead opening titles.
Oh, dear.
The setting, yes, the setting is up to date, but you just have this incredible sense watching it that these two actors, the two main actors, are having the time of their lives setting themselves up. I mean, they look like they're just in on this joke all the way through. And in the third episode, up pops the New Zealand comedian Rhys Darby.
Oh, dear.
He's been around for a while. He's done some stand-up. He's done some films. And he was the principal guest role in this episode. And he was still speaking with a absolutely pure New Zealand accent.
Excellent.
It stood out like anything. He was playing the funny guy. David Duchovny was the straight guy. Let me think if I got this right. He was the Bud Abbott to the other guy's Lou Costello, or whatever which way you wanted to say. It was quite funny, stupid again, but funny. But how much longer would I want to watch it? That is the question. I think I've got what they're up to now. And unless there's some real wicked turn of events that's about to happen, I think after 3 episodes, I feel like, I think I've got it now. I'm not sure if I'm necessarily going to want to see it all the way through. That's the only thing I'd say.
There's 3 more episodes to go. Do you not have that loyalty as a viewer? Do you not feel invested in this now?
A little bit. But I would. It's more out of curiosity than out of a burning desire.
They even dragged in a Kiwi just for you.
Yes, they did. Okay.
Just to keep their Antipodean viewers happy, and that's the kind of loyalty that you've got for them. You should be ashamed.
Oh, gosh. I don't want to be accused of being unpatriotic. Now, I want to hear about how your partner got a ticket for a very famous musical event.
This is one of the most bizarre musical happenings that we've had in New Zealand in quite some time, isn't it? We suddenly saw press releases about a week ago saying that Prince is coming to New Zealand.
Yeah.
He's never been here before to play. I mean, I'm sure he's visited. Why wouldn't you come here?
Yes.
I mean, even Taylor Swift comes here not to play, but less said about that, the better. But yes, he's doing his first concerts here, and he announced in the beginning of February that he'll be playing in Auckland at the end of February. Which in itself seemed a bit weird when bands typically give, of his stature, typically give 6 months to a year's notice. He gave less than 6 weeks. He announced he was going to play two dates in one night at the ASB Theatre in Auckland. And it was going to be his piano and a microphone tour. So instead of the ridiculous, huge, overblown Purple Rain sets where you got, I don't know, people swinging from the ceiling, wherever they're doing Prince shows, it's going to be just him on the stage on his own with the piano.
Okay.
And you can imagine the music world went a little bit crazy about this. tickets went on sale, and Debbie decided that she was going to try and get tickets. And so she logged on to, I believe it was Ticketmaster, were the ticket agents,
yeah,
and looked to get a couple of tickets. Two was the limit that was being offered to any one purchaser, and she couldn't get any, and tried again and couldn't get any. Now, Ticketmaster, to be fair, are evil. They're a dreadful company who go out of their way to stand between you and your tickets. They're awful. They it's like they're invested in not letting you see the bands you want to see. A bizarre business model. So in the end, after about half an hour of constantly hitting refresh, she finally gave up and thought, oh, well, I guess I just won't get to see Prince. A friend of hers on Facebook then posted something about, I really wish I could have got two tickets, but they're only selling singles and I don't feel like going on my own.
Right.
So Debbie then promptly went back on, looked for one ticket, and got one ticket in row E. Which is not a bad effort, really.
Oh, E, yeah, that sounds pretty close.
Pretty decent. I mean, in a small venue, that's not shabby.
Yep.
That's really not bad at all. So she got that boxed off, and I said, oh, don't worry, I'll come along with you, because I'm sure I'll pick up a review ticket.
Ah.
Yeah, right.
You're right.
This is Prince.
Yes.
All bets are off. Nobody, from what I gather, is getting review tickets or photography passes. Because, let's face it, he doesn't care.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't need it.
He doesn't need it. I mean, you know, the show sold out in no time without the help of us publicising and promoting it.
Mm.
Makes you feel a bit redundant, doesn't it?
E by gum. Yeah. I should just say, so we don't end up in court next week, that was, of course, Steve's freely given opinion about the aforementioned ticket company, and
they
his own experience. So
Crave's official in-house legal team have asked us to point out that they are not technically evil. We have no evidence that they've actually ever made pacts with the devil.
No.
We just strongly suspect it.
Yes, but that's your experience of them. That's your experience of them. And that's
look, here's my experience of them. When the Rolling Stones were selling tickets nearly 2 years ago, Debbie and I decided we were going to go, and we logged on the moment tickets went on sale, and we got tickets for, I think, something like row E or row F, really good seats. We got those, add to shopping cart, added, hit sell, checkout, credit card at the ready, hit the checkout button. Says, we're sorry, your request has timed out.
Ah, the old timed out thing. Yeah.
And it, I mean, it timed out within, 15 seconds. They stand in the way of you buying the seats that you want. We ended up about 30 rows further back when we finally managed to get the tickets booked that we want. They don't make it easy for you. I don't understand what their model is. I don't like them.
All right, then. Yeah. One thing I like, which I'm just going to just mention.
They are evil.
Forward ahead, a little later this year. I'm not sure what month. But the aforementioned Springsteen, who I have a passing affection for the man's work.
Yes, you've mentioned that in passing. Yeah, you should. Yes. You really should talk more about that.
Yeah, I think I should. He's one of these artists who many people have written about books about him. Not maybe as many as have written about Dylan or the Beatles, but he's getting up there. You know, biographies and photographic essays and whatnot. Well, after. At the age of, what, is he 66 or 67? He's finally written a book himself about himself.
Yes, he has. That would be his autobiography.
That would be. That's the one. And that's to be released this year.
Yes.
So I just thought I'd just throw that into the mix. You'll doubtless be waiting at the local bookstore in a queue to get one.
I shall be waiting for the delivery truck to arrive to intercept my copy, definitely, yes. I think that's a given.
It's a given. Anyway, hey, what else is coming up that we need to keep an eye out for?
Coming up, are you going to see Dan's Army next week?
Well, I think that I should, because I grew up with it and had, as many New Zealanders did when it was broadcast here. You would have been like, were you in the UK when it was being broadcast?
It's one of my earliest comedy memories.
Yeah, I mean, people loved it here. It was really a program that just struck a chord with many New Zealanders, especially the ones who came from British stock and who had relatives who went through the Second World War. I mean, it was, you know, it's. I've had a bit of a. I've seen a trailer, and I have read a review, which gives me a little bit of what's the word?
Pause.
However, I think given the history, I think we must see it.
And the cast.
Yeah.
Have you seen the cast?
Yes, very good.
It looks like it's going to be fantastic. Just watch those. Yeah, I've heard differing things about the quality of the story, but with a cast like that, I mean, Michael Gambon as who's he playing? Not Wilson.
No, he's the old doddery one. Godfrey.
Godfrey, thank you. Yeah, Private Godfrey. Alone right there, that makes it worthwhile. and they've got Toby Jones as Captain Mannering. And yes. I think that was probably a role he was born to play. So so we'll be there. We're also going to be looking at... I'm looking at my calendar here. Tonight, I'm off to see Jackie Bristow, a Kiwi folk singer who's been making a name for herself in the US over the last couple of years. And she's coming back to New Zealand. She played Auckland last night. She's playing Howick in Auckland tonight, and I'll be there. I'm hoping to catch up with her tonight. We've got... what else have we got coming up? He says, looking at his calendar pointedly. We've got Clash of Titans. Do you remember a Kiwi heavy metal band called Dragon?
I certainly do.
Got to see them next week at Auckland's Town Hall. And then the following week, it's actually going to be after we record our next one, we'll make a mention of it right now. Tammy Nielsen is going to be playing in Auckland, doing a free concert on the 28th.
Okay. Good.
That's going to be worth seeing. That's in Mercer Park. Myers Park. I do beg your pardon.
Mercer Park, yes.
Yes, you do have the city named after you, don't you, sir? I forgot that, yes.
Okay, very good. And I should just mention quickly, I have caught quite a few of the superhero films. Not all of them, but quite a few of them. And there's one that's just out that promises to take a really irreverent, a different take. This is a famous character in the Marvel Universe called Deadpool.
Yes.
Played by the Canadian actor Ryan Reynolds, which I might just have a look at that one. It might be a hard one to work on film. He's a swearing, cussing, violence-loving bad guy, a good bad guy who breaks all the rules. It worked in the comic genre. I don't know. It might work in the film. It'd be interesting to see. Anyway, I might just have a passing look at that. So there's a lot coming up. Excellent.
We're going to be busy. The things we do for our listeners.
Oh, God, all six of them. Now, where are we? I think we've kind of run out of time here.
I think we've also run out of content, so it works out quite nice. works out quite nicely. It's so all right. No one's listening anymore anyway. They've all got bored and gone home.
You and I are listening. This is Crave.
Well, you're listening.
I'm listening. This is Crave. And he's Steve and I'm Simon. And if you want to get in touch with us, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
We're on Facebook, obviously. You'll never guess where to find us on Facebook. And failing, if that's too much, we're also on Twitter at Crave Podcast.
Lovely.
And obviously we're on the web as well, worldwideweb.cravepodcast.com. But if you're listening to this, you've probably found that already.
Yeah. Sorry, I spoke over the top of you. Very unprofessional of me.
You can't get decent help these days.
Yeah, I know. God. Anyway, I was just saying that my name, which is Simon Mercip, and he is...
Steve McCabe.
That's what's been entertaining us this week.
Thank you very much.